Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 189, Buddhist Psychonauts and Their Yogic Technology.
So now we are going to, never mind all this, don't even worry about it. We are going to the Psychonauts. Yes, we're going because we're in Tantra, you know. So now let me remind you that this course, anyway, this is about the Dalai Lama's force for good. And so the whole point of himself in the force for good is making the Buddhist discoveries about the mind and about reality available to everyone, whether they're Buddhists or not. So as the author of the book, who wrote it for His Holiness Dan Goldman, told me when I told him about it, he said the point about the force for good is to do these things without them being Buddhism. So the course was entitled The Buddhist Sources. So now, in the last session, Tom and I were with you, and then tonight, we're on the subject of Tantra. And I entitled them by the name of three of the most important Tantras. And but that doesn't mean that we're now going to do Buddhism, because we're doing the force for good. So we're looking at the Buddhist sources. And among the things that the force for good does, in what way are the Tantras the Buddhist sources? That's where I'm trying to start today. I would call it Buddhist neuroscience, basically. And it is the province of these people who I call the psychonauts, who are the Mahasiddhas, the great adepts, and their yogic texts and arts, technologies and arts. And this is where they deal with the brain, but not just the brain in the head, the brain throughout the entire body. And they deal with the brain in order to develop the cultivation of love, compassion, joy, and equilibrium, in order to develop the art of lucid sleeping, lucid dreaming, and lucid awakening, no longer unenlightened sleepwalking. Oh, I like that. The art of positive reimagining, creatively sustaining environment, reinforcing societies, and the art of conscious evolution, controlled traversal of death, lucid dying, and voluntary reincarnating. So that's it. And then this is very important, the schema, which we will talk about. And some of you, if you have trouble seeing it, if you're online, and welcome everyone who's online, if you have the introduction to my Book of the Dead translation, you have some tables in there, and these are pretty much the same as some of those tables. So this is surprising that without all the machinery of electron microscopes and, you know, MRIs and fMRIs and all this kind of thing, and EEGs, that the Buddhists themselves were working with the brain, actually. And all of these things that have been discovered, like neuroplasticity, due to the Dalai Lama's dialogue with the different scientists, or in the same time as the Dalai Lama's dialogue with Richard Davidson and other neuroscientists, and also Davidson's work about how compassion meditation actually changes the circulation and circuitry in the brain, and combine that with neuroplasticity. And if you meditate on certain, not just meditate period, but you meditate on certain themes, in certain ways, this then affects the way the brain is organized. And they are not even beginning to get into the overall body, not just the brain itself, but the overall central nervous system of the whole body, which is the chakra system of the Buddhist. You know, Buddha makes a big thing about selflessness in the exoteric teaching. And the super subtle body mind is kind of like a soul, actually. It's the super subtle self. Although the selflessness is only a fixed and unchanging thing. All of the things, all of the body and mind parts or ways of looking at it, whatever they are, they're all completely process elements. You know, they're not like unchanging thing. There's no unchanging thing going on at all. So that's what we're doing with the, tantra. And why are we doing that? Remember, when you take a bodhisattva vow, when you conceive the spirit of enlightenment, the bodhicitta, in other words, conceiving it means you get the idea suddenly that you are an evolutionary being and that there's no limit to your evolution, and your evolution can go negative or positive over endless future lives, and that it's possible that it can go to the supremely positive, which is Buddhahood, and not only possible, but given infinite time, you know, I guess one could waste one's time infinitely, too. But it's really very unlikely that one would, especially if encouraged by one of the things that one needs to conceive the spirit of enlightenment, which is one needs to encounter an enlightened being in some way. You know, encounter one like in the lifetime of the Buddha that would be encountering Shakyamuni Buddha, or even some of the arhats who were already pretty enlightened. In the terms of later times, they were always great enlightened masters. In the modern period, it's very difficult, but you can also encounter a Buddha in a text through a book, you know, with your imagination. You can encounter in a dream, etc. But it's considered that you really have to have an encounter with some sort of a higher type of being that you sort of subliminally sense is this higher type of being. You sort of feel that. And it must be there. Like when I met my original teacher, I just knew there was something about him that I had to study with him, and I had to find out what it was that he thought I might be able to learn. And then someone asked me, like, well, you just met him. He's like this humble guy in a little house in New Jersey. You know, like, you've just been in India and you're going back to India. Why are you saying now he's your teacher and throwing away your ticket and everything? And I said, well, I know he's there because he can help me. Well, why do you think so? I said, well, because he doesn't have any use for me himself, I said. And he said, what do you mean? How do you know that? And I said, well, he's not really even there, I said. Although he was very much there. He was serving tea and he was telling me I couldn't get enlightened because I was an idiot and probably unless I learned to shape up and all kinds of, I mean, he was very manifesting. But I sensed that, you know, because I'd met a lot of gurus by then, in not just all Buddhists, in other parts of the world at that time. And one thing about some kinds of holy people is that you feel that they're huge beings and they're sort of very full there. And they're there, you know what I mean? And you're sort of off on the corner because they're so there, you know. Whereas this guy wasn't there at all. I sensed, but I didn't know what I was talking about, of course. I had no idea, but subliminally it just came spurting out of me. Which I learned that he was aware of his selflessness in that sense, you know, and he didn't want to put me in his Dharma Center business, you know, the way all of the lamas and gurus tend to do, you know, like to join his corporation, you know. He was just really there for me in a certain way. I could sense it, you know, and that was borne out after through many years of activity with that particular gentleman, the late So one meets some person like that, and then one gets the idea that it's possible to be this other kind of being that has in their own field the centers not around a cycle of worry and anxiety and like self-awareness and self-whatever description and whatever, like maneuvering their way through a world that they're different from, but has within them a kind of well of bliss, a fountain of bliss, which is quiet and calm. It's not like exuding or oozing out of them at all. It's just there, you know. and you feel it, you know, and because it's calm, you know, and it's something different. And you feel that, and you feel you could be that. And then you can say, oh, and how do I do that? Oh, I become a bodhisattva. And then as a bodhisattva, I devote my life to all beings, and I express my interconnection with all beings in, from the very beginning of being like one with them all, and that we're, I'm doing this for all of them, as part of all of them, something like that. Bodhisattva vow is sort of like that. And it's also very practical, you know, in the sense that it can only really arise in someone who does feel connected like that and realizes they're not going to get away from all these other beings anyway. So they might as well be a Buddha. It's the only way to tolerate that situation, in fact. Right? Imagine if you never get away from anybody. Your mother-in-law, your ex, your, like, what, the corner policeman, whatever, the cockroach. Then the best is to be, like, able to tolerate it totally and happily and help them be happier. So what I'm getting to with the bodhisattva, going back over the bodhisattva thing, is that then the bodhisattva says, okay, I'm ready to stay here for 3 incalculable aeons of lifetimes to evolve my body-mind complex, you know, life after life, endlessly, you know, and I'll give my life infinite numbers of times to every being. It will be the way where I will overcome attachment to my life, to my body, to my possessions, to my relationships, to my whatever identity, and give it away constantly, 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 and then have to be reborn and get reattached, and then do it again, and again, again, again. So it's like one signs up. In a way, that's why you can't do it if you don't think there is a future life. There's no point to it. You don't need it. You're just not going to exist after death. So there's no point to make a big stress and strain about helping all beings, because you won't be able to if that is the case. But if you feel that it's real practical that you're going to continue, then you might as well continue in an optimal way, is the idea. So so there's where Tantra comes in. When you do that and have that bodhisattva vow, in the Buddha's case, and you have that bodhisattva vow, and that's why, actually, in the theories of Tantra, there's an English scholar at Oxford who's quite bright and nice, named Alexis Sanderson. And he had a teacher in Kashmir who was a Shaiva teacher, who was a scholarly great teacher. And he gave him a lot of texts that a lot of people hadn't seen. And he read all these texts. And then he noticed, he learned Sanskrit, read all these texts. And then he noticed that a lot of passages and things in the text were similar to what's in a lot of Buddhist tantric texts, especially the Chakrasamvara Tantra. By the way, that's our topic today. But, you know, I'm not really covering it. I'm talking about how it is a resource of the force for good, actually, in a sort of ultimate way, you know. And this is, and the reason for that is that last week we talked a little bit about Guhya Samaja Tantra, which is considered by some to be the sort of foremost, what they call father tantra. And it's considered foremost father tantra. And the father is the compassion embodiment side of things. And therefore, it particularly relates to practices that are connected to the magic body or the illusion body, as people rudely call it. And I correctly call it the magic body, the Maya Deha. And that's the way in which you rehearse becoming a Buddha, in a sort of meditationally conceived and developed dream body, dreamlike body, for which you use your visualization, stabilized visualization that you have done in the creation stage, where you have learned to be able to re-envision yourself as, you know, a Vajra Yogini or Chakrasambhara or some, so, you know, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, whatever particular a Buddha deity form you have chosen, or you know, that you have learned to visualize yourself as. And then in this state of the magic body, very advanced state, it's like you're in, the world is like a dream, and you actually feel you're in such a body, and then you can actually do things in such a body, like a controlled lucid dream sort of thing, but a dream in a special sort of situation, which I'll try to explain. So that's the father tantra. And then the Chakrasamvara is the supreme of the mother tantras. And the mother is the clear light, the immersion in the clear light. She is the ultimate reality, clear light, or transparency, The word light is a little misleading, because it's a kind of a light that one has never seen, because it has no opposite of darkness. And therefore, transparency is actually the best translation for it. And its analogy is the gray pre-dawn twilight, where you can see your hand, but you can't see the lines on the palm of your hand. So gray is like a mixture of black and white, right? But it's not a dull gray like that. It's a lucid, luminous, transparent gray. It's sort of the deepest form of light or something like that. So they still do call it Prabhasvara, you know, clear light, light clear. But Prabha means light. But they specify it's not sunlight or moonlight, which are the two bright phases of the subtle mind. Okay, so that's this, and then the Kala Chakra is a subcategory of the Mother Tantra that has some very special, wonderful qualities that we will talk more about next week, and that I'm always talking about. It's holiness is always talking about. It's a really special thing, and but it is itself within the Mother Tantra category, that it is a more clear light thing. That's why the palette in the mandala of the mother of the Kala Chakra is very pastel type of color. It's very special. Okay, but anyway, I'm talking about Chakra Samhara, Mother Tantra in general. So now let's look at this schema. In the schema of the psychonauts, this business here is the coarse body mind, right, which is, of course, flesh and blood, or sometimes they call the coarse body mind, they refer to it as the sixth sense organ, sixth sense organs, meaning because the skin is a sense organ, and the eyes, the ear, the nose, the mouth, the tongue, you know, these are sense organs. So that is what the coarse body is. And then the coarse mind is the sixfold consciousness that aligns itself with any of the six senses. And the sixth sense is technically not really physical. The sixth sense is the mental sense, which is very explained in a very complicated way in Buddhist epistemology and psychology, so we don't need to worry about it. But basically, it's the inner mind that pays attention to this or that sense thing usually, and can also go into inner realms using imagination and so on, is the sixth sense. Then the subtle body mind is this chakra system, which is composed of za, lung, tigle, you know, nadi, prana or vayu, and bindu in Sanskrit, or za, lung, tigle in Tibetan, which mean channels, which are nerves, nerve channel, energies. So the channels, which are they say 72,000 nerve channels, which stem out of a kind of tree-like central axial channel with two right and left companion axial channels. There are actually more, but the most important ones are two. And then with the different ganglia or complexes, they usually use five, the brain, the throat, the heart, the navel, and the genital chakra. And then sometimes there are intermediate ones, because the chakras, in a way, are programming. They're software. They're structuring. They're not actually, in other words, if you dissect somebody, you're not going to find the heart chakra. You're going to find the heart, and you're going to find a lot of nerves around that heart, and in and around the spine and so on, in the center of the body at that level, but you're not going to find like a beautiful umbrella with eight spokes and a pet lotus petal and things like that. You won't find. It's just wetware, or I call it slimeware, actually, the nervous system. But anyway, the subtle body mind, so that's the physical body, the neural channels, energies, and neurotransmitters, which are the bindu, which are these chemicals, like adrenochrome and serotonin, all this kind of thing. All of those are neurotransmitters. And then the subtle mind is three states of luminance. And they are, the first one is like a inner experience of being a realm of empty space that the mind has, that you can reach through meditation also. And you go through when you die, and actually very quickly when you fall asleep, although you don't notice it usually, or when you faint and lose consciousness. So there's a layer of sort of moonlight space, not a moon, but just moonlit space, like a white light space. Then there's a reddish light, hot solar space, very brilliant hot space. And then there's a dark space that's a brilliant darkness, so sort of like a shiny black, if you can imagine. And those three realms, I call them luminance, radiance, and immanence. And they are considered knowledges or intuitions. And they are just direct experiences of those three things. So in other words, when you're fully in your own central nervous system, you are just that kind of spatial consciousness. And that is why, for example, in Guhya Samaja, and in many of, you know, he has three faces, which are blackish, black, red, and white, white and red, in a different order than you'd expect, but there are three colors. And that means that that's one reason, that's a clue as to why they say Guhya Samaja is the best of the father tantras connected with the magic body. Because if you can become conscious at the subtle mind level of yourself as those sort of three awarenesses of those three luminosities, and yet they are your sort of mind, then the energy flows within your nervous system are in a perfect balance. And you are able to consciously arise toward more coarse matter, and shape that coarse matter according to your mind. So is the idea. So that's why the faces are the colors of those subtle states in a certain way. They symbolize that to the person. And Chakrasambhara, for example, has a black similar. The front face is also black, and then the right face is. Is yellow, golden, actually, and the back is red, and the left is green. So it's a different kind of order of things. Kalachakra, again, has black and red and white and yellow in the back. So Kalachakra is even different. And those are all having to do with different ways you're sort of dealing with your subtle mind in a way, with those faces, what they mean, you know. It's very interesting. And, I mean, even just imagine yourself right now, you're looking at me with two eyes, those of you who are not asleep already. and yet imagine if you had three eyes in each face and you were four of them, and what would be being transmitted into your brain? You know, like stimuli from four directions of quite a lot of visual stimuli, quite a lot of light would be coming into your brain. Your brain would be handling it and have to restructure itself in order to do that, if you can imagine that. Which you do when you practice the creation states. You do that kind of imagination. And then when you do that, then that does restructure your brain. Anyway, without consciously sort of going directly into the brain, just by feeling that the brain is issuing forth in different sense faculties, put it that way. So then the super subtle body-mind, this is the big one. And this one, in a way, is beyond conception. You'll see soon when you see how it's defined. The body are the super subtle physical energies. They're still called wind, but a subtle wind. Because wind just means wind in the Buddhist thing doesn't mean the breeze blowing. If you feel breeze on your face, there are also atoms in the old Buddhist idea. There's earth elements. Any sort of solidity of touch, that's earth. And any sense of cohesiveness is water, and any warmth is fire, and the movement itself is the wind. That's all, just the movement. So it really means energy, you know, a vayu in that case, you know, it does. And there's, you know, none of those elements, those are just sort of, therefore, abstract forces or something like that, or qualities. And they're always combined, actually, in any actual physical object. And so... So the super subtle one is still called wind because it's motion, it's energy. But it is, it actually is not dividable from clear light, bliss void mind, which is the subtle, super subtle mind. And that, when you withdraw to, you know, when you meditate, like there are meditations where you have body mandalas, Like when you say you're Guhya Samaja, then however you have a body mandala of the whole mandala building with 32 deities in the Akshobhyavadra version of Guhya Samaja, for example, where you have a body mandala in a tiny little drop the size of a split pea, or even of a mustard seed. Well, the main deity is the size of a mustard seed, but then the whole mandala is like the size of a pea. And then, you know, and then you develop a kind of imaginative microscope where you visualize all those deities at that size, and yet through meditative stabilization, you can actually see them at that size. So it's the way your mind goes down into like micro size, and something like that, if you follow me. And the building is tiny, et cetera, like this. And then there's a thing where you draw from that and then make it big and then fuse it with the big one outside, you know, which is also you. I mean, this is just really, it really requires incredible meditative ability to do these things, which I don't pretend to have, but at least I respect, and because I've studied what they are. And on the other hand, at the super subtle level, So therefore, going to the super subtle, you're going down and you're sort of going into the micro realm and withdrawing from the coarse reality entirely, and even the subtle reality, you're going to the super subtle. But when you reach the clear light mind is everywhere. It's infinite. It's the Buddha mind. It's no different from Buddha's mind, the clear light mind. The difference from a Buddha, we all have the same minds, therefore, as the Buddha, in this kind of technical way of putting it. It's so brilliant, you know, scientifically. We all have it, but our problem is we're not aware of these other levels of our mind. We're completely engaged in this coarse level only, where we're the separate being with things, and our senses are like fending them off or experiencing them or looking at them. And these other things we go back into when we sleep, when we die, and when we have orgasm, when we faint, when we pass out, when we yawn a little bit even. The yawning exercise is bringing energy into the center of the subtle thing. But normally, otherwise, we're completely unaware of that. You know, it's barred from us. And then the reason we die when we get down to the clear light, when we disidentify from all the coarse thing, the reason it's called death is because at that moment, one is on the very brink of infinity. So it skitters away from being connected to a finite thing, if you follow me. But what skitters away? Ignorance maintains a super subtle form of being separate, if you follow me. So therefore, the super subtle form just shoots right across that infinity experience and immediately looks to find a way of being separate from everything and, like, you know, maneuver through it. So it then shapes, you know, what sort of a embodiment that would seem to be separate you want, depending on what you've been attracted to in your previous life. And, you know, you to be born as a human or to be born as something. But again, it's across a barrier of complete unconsciousness. And so it's like in a dream where you have no control over what might happen to you if you haven't explored that, if you follow me. So it's no wonder, even though in Buddhist cultures, people were not necessarily, very few were aware of this sort of esoteric level, and in some of the Buddhist countries they don't even have it anymore, although actually like the most orthodox Sri Lanka Buddhist community in the second millennium had Tantra, and they had the esoteric teaching and the Mahayana teaching for up until around 950 or so of the Common Era. So for the first, you know, 1300 years that they had Buddhism, they had the full package, let's call it. You know, but then they sort of reverted back to just, oh, we don't want that stuff, and then they forgot about it. But what I'm saying, that Buddhists who have this sense, they get very concerned to use their life. That's why then there are so many meditation centers in these cultures. There are so many people who become, academics, which means monks and nuns, you know, academic in the sense of living on alms. Low salary, but enough to be alive so they can study, because they're not doing regular, productive work in the sense of materially or economically productive. And because they are very concerned that they must become aware of more layers and levels of their conscience. And that's why in Buddhist psychology, the unconscious is not an absolute thing. In other words, it's there for the ordinary sleepwalking person, but the enlightened person becomes aware, conscious of the unconscious. So the task is to become fully aware of your unconscious, actually. And that's considered dangerous, you know, so that's why that's also esoteric, because you're going into the unconscious, you know.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was originally recorded at the Force for Good class series with Robert Thurman and friends in 2017. This annual series continues December 17th, 2018, online and in person from Tibet House, U.S. with Robert Thurman. To learn more about the online presentation and in-person class, please visit tibethouse.us. And be sure to check out past episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, which also come from the Force for Good class series. As we heard in the first part of this week's episode, Professor Thurman led us through an in-depth exploration of some of the esoteric teachings found in Tibetan Buddhism. If you find yourself a little lost in some of the terminology and some of the more subtle ideas, including about coarse subtle and super subtle, look in the podcast description. I've linked to several old podcasts, and there's also going to be a video linked in the podcast description that'll help elucidate these topics. They can be a little intimidating if you're not familiar with them, but if you've been listening to the Bob Thurman Podcast recently, you'll be noticing a theme that all the teachings dovetail into Professor Thurman's teachings on non-dualism, bliss, and the discovery of the Buddha. I hope you're enjoying the way that we're interconnecting these podcasts and our video content. We hope to make our content a little bit more tangible and understandable, and we'd love your feedback. I can be reached on most social media platforms through my name, Justin Stone Diaz, or you can follow me online as JustSD on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and any other social media platform you might find yourself on. I'm probably there. I'd love to connect with you, and the only way I can grow as a producer and creator is through feedback and hearing how you like these podcasts or if there's areas you think we can improve. Special thanks to the Tibet House membership community who've been making these podcasts available and been giving us great feedback about how we can improve our audio and visual recording techniques. If you're inspired by our work here, please consider becoming a Tibet House member. Benefits of membership include special discounts to programs at Tibet House US in New York City and at Menla Retreat Dewa Spa in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York. To learn more about upcoming programs at Menla, including the annual New Year's Dharma and Yoga Retreat with Sharon Salzberg, please visit menla.us. Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and Gary Gok in the second half of this week's episode.
So that's the super subtle body-mind idea. It's really very, very amazing idea, you know. And that's why, you know, I never say supernatural anything that happens in Buddhism, you know, or in the world. They're super normal, but not supernatural. Because nature includes this really area where the mind is really powerful. And it isn't that everything just is the mind. In a way, at this super subtle level, you could say everything is mind because body and mind are the same. And His Holiness, in the talks with the scientists, I've been begging His Holiness and various people in the dialogue to please let the Western materialist scientists know that the Buddhists don't mind materialistic reductionism. I mean, theoretically, no. They do know by the way the Dalai Lama behaves, but they've been hiding this because it's secret. You know, it's esoteric in a way, although it's known, it's published, but still people don't get it. Because like you say, body and mind. So you think, oh yeah, okay, there's that body-mind duality, physical-mental duality, even down to super subtle level. But no, there isn't. Because the clear light of the void and the mind of bliss that is one with the clear light of the void are one thing, you know, and the energies of it. And then that's also, it's further paradoxical and inconceivable, like the quantum people have this idea of the infinite mathematically traced infinite energy of the vacuum. That a perfect vacuum has infinite energy. But, and the reason that there's no motion in it, like energy as motion, is that everything is already done. So there, it's completely quiescent, but can be drawn from infinitely, you know. So the clear light of the void, which is not a light, and it's not a darkness, and it is infinite energy, and but it doesn't do anything, and our mind is one with it, and everything is made of it, and it is the deepest nature of everything. And if you know that, you're really happy. Except you're not happy because the only way you know it is to melt into it through bliss. And when you melt into it through bliss, you feel you are everybody else. And then since you are them and they're not happy, you're still not quite happy. So you could, unless you make them happy. So then you become automatic make them happy machine. That's what a Buddha is, right? Because they're really not them to you even, in a way. They are and they aren't, you know, like everything. So you can't make it fall down on either side of anything. Right? You got that? But because you have melted into this infinity blissfully, you can bear that being aware that they are not happy. And therefore, you're inexhaustible in your ability and skill to help them become happy. And not only that, then there's the other element that we can console ourselves with is the time element. You're also infinite in time, not just in space. So you can see the optimal path for them to become where they evolved to their own Buddhahood, all of them, even the cockroach. And so you're just as, that's just as present to you as the present is when they are going to do that with your help. But you are going to be helping them. They, you know, as I said, otherwise they could waste their time cockroaching around infinitely too. I mean, infinity has no—it's not fate. It has no infinity has no determining role or function. But just a space, like a space or a time in which things can happen. Eternity, eternal infinity. But what determines is your love and compassion and your skill and your interaction with them, your art. You're creating a situation in which they will finally figure it out. When you become a bodhisattva, you sign up for that, you join that team, and then you're really capable, you become the capable bodhisattva as a Buddha because you realize that you already have all the equipment and all the knowledge that you need. Because you become conscious of the infinite, your infinite energy of your clear light, supposedly. And even in the Kala Chakra, you know, because I'm mixing the two, you know, in a way. Some people came for Kala Chakra, don't be discouraged. in the Kala Chakra, I think I told you, but I was amazed in editing the Vimala Prabha, which means the stainless light, fifth chapter, which is perfection stage chapter. And Pundarika is the eighth king of Shambhala, supposedly. Pundarika means a white lotus. And he wrote a commentary on the short version of the Tantra, which is the only one we have, which was created by his father, who was a Manjushri, Yashas, the seventh king, and then who asked him to make a commentary on it called Vimala Prabha. And he said he's supposed to be incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, this Pundarika guy. So on one verse, verse 127 of that fifth chapter, he spends 47 Sanskrit pages, which is like 80-some English pages, arguing relentlessly that a Buddha has no atoms in a Buddha's body. Buddha's body is non-atomic. But it doesn't mean it's not energetic, so it doesn't mean it's non-material, because at that level, there's no difference between mind and matter. So they're not Vijnanavadins. Although Kalachakra's face, one of his faces is ready to teach Vijnanavada, you know, the mind-only school. One of his faces is ready to teach Hinayana, two different versions of Hinayana, of, you know, Theravada, dualistic Buddhism. And only the front face teaches Madhyamaka, you know, just to show that it's like all of the different views are useful. And even the non-Buddhist views, as Vimalakirti said, the enlightenment of Buddha is to be found in every kind of view, every human view that there is. I guess that goes for Republicans. I can't believe it. Anyway, so sorry, everyone. It's just the season, you know. So that means that a Buddha actually is one who designs himself and a world and the environment, but cannot redesign other beings. They have to do it themselves, but designs everything else to maximize beings' evolutionary progress to enlightenment. That's what it means. As a sort of wave force, you know, like a subatomic wave force. It's kind of fun. It's kind of a really interesting way of thinking about it, I think. And that Pundarika, by the way, I think Dalai Lama and that Pundarika are one incarnation line, although they never say that, Tibetans. Because why do you explain his complete obsession with the Kala Chakra Tantra? No Dalai Lamas have ever done more than once or twice in their lifetime a Kala Chakra initiation. He's up to number 34 or something, you know, and he's really into it. And he loves doing it, actually. It's tiring when he's not feeling well, but he does love doing it. It's really, and he doesn't skimp at all. And then there's a self-initiation, which is equally long, where he goes through the initiation, like initiating himself and the people and the monks who are doing it. So he goes through that many times with visualization and so on. All the offerings he does are really, there's whole special scripts about all the offerings that are really elaborate, you know, with eight conch shells made of silver pouring milk and et cetera, et cetera. It's amazing, actually. And he just completely does it because by doing all of that, then it makes it much more auspicious for all those who receive the blessing, mostly just receiving the blessing, because mostly the people don't really know what they're doing. And you know, those of us who are getting older, we have aches and pains, and we have, you know, our body is kind of like doesn't really do everything we want it to do or feel like we want it to feel all the time, so on. So if we imagine, you know, like when we're sitting quietly somewhere or something, we sort of think about that there's this central channel and the right and left and the little knots, and then even we've imagined that the knots unravel themselves, and in a sort of a little bit magic way, they don't break anything, but they just unravel. And then they're like three little balloons, you know, like those long hot dog balloons that they make dogs and cats out of, you know. Like Jeff Koons makes the zillion-dollar metal sculptures shaping out like balloons like that. But these are these long balloons, a red one, a white one, and a blue one, red inside and blue outside, and that the energy is kind of there, and in the center of the heart level of that energy, there is your super subtle energy, and then you sort of the miracle world comes through that to you, you know, this Buddha world comes from the microverse, the micro Buddhist universes in there, come through there. And then there's a thing where you mentally imagine like a tractor beam comes from there, and where you have an ache in your knee, it's like a nerve impulse, energy impulse coming from some blockage of some kind, and the tractor beam goes out and it pulls that, what's causing that pain, pulls that blockage and pulls it into the infinity in the center of your heart, and it sort of combs your nervous system free of blocks and obstructions and things like that. And you sort of, you know, subliminally affirm yourself as, you know, your subtle body self and your super subtle body mind as more in control of your coarse body mind. And therefore, kind of like overlaying it with a network of positive energy, something like that. Getting used to doing that. You know, just, you know, like when you're just snoozing or when you're just relaxing, to sort of revert to that, you know, default to that kind of thinking, I think it helps. I think it really helps a lot. And it's good, it's a good practice.
A poem by Jacques Prévert, translated from French, mostly by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. To paint the portrait of a bird. First, paint a cage with an open door. Then paint something pretty, something simple, something beautiful, something useful for the bird. Then place the canvas within a tree, in a garden, in a wood, or in a forest. Hide behind the tree without speaking, without moving. Sometimes the bird comes quickly, but he can just as well spend long years before deciding. Don't get discouraged. Wait. Wait years if necessary. The swiftness or slowness of the coming of the bird having no rapport with the outcome of your picture. When the bird comes, if he comes, observe the most profound silence. Wait till the bird enters the cage, and when he is entered, gently close the door with a brush. Then paint out all the bars one by one, taking care not to touch any of the feathers of the bird. Then paint the portrait of the tree, choosing the most beautiful of its branches for the bird. Paint also the green foliage and the wind's freshness, the dust of the sun, and the noise of insects in the summer heat, then wait for the bird to decide to sing. If the bird doesn't sing, it's a bad sign, a sign that your painting is bad. But if he sings, it's a good sign, a sign that you can sing. So then, so gently, you pull out one of the feathers of the bird, and you write your name in a corner of the canvas. To Paint the Portrait of a Bird was published in a book called Words, Parole, by Jacques Prévert in 1946. The year before, he wrote the screenplay to a film called Les Enfants de Paradis, which some people consider their favorite film of all time, something like The French Gone with the Wind. In 1956, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who is now 99, published Jacques Prévert in English in his Pocket Poets series of City Lights. To paint the portrait of a bird is the answer to a question which is not spoken. Have you painted your portrait of a bird? I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. May all beings be well.